Will you pray with me? Holy, holy, holy Lord, the whole earth is full of your glory. Now open us to the power and beauty of your presence in this room, in this moment, in our lives, in your world. Amen. For some people, this weekend brings one of the most important decisions of the season: gas or charcoal? Talking about grilling, of course, and though the Memorial Day holiday is meant to be a day for remembering with gratitude those who lost their lives in service to our country, the fact is, for many of us, it also kicks off grilling season. And the question of what kind of grill is one of many dividing lines in our country. Our family is very proudly a charcoal family. We love the taste. We love the smell. We love that with charcoal, you can get your grill really, really hot. That's also a downside, of course. I can remember when our sons were quite young, how vigilant we had to be about keeping them away from the grill when we were barbecuing. We had explained to them again every year how dangerous it was to get too close to the grill, because from the outside, especially from a little person's perspective, it doesn't look like anything's happening in there. And then one summer evening, when the boys were about 4 or 5 years old, one of them walked right up to that shiny grill and put his hand on the side of it. You can imagine the screams and the tears that followed, and not all of them were his. If you've ever accidentally touched a burning coal, or even just the side of a charcoal grill, then you know it's hot. We had told them to stay away from the grill and the coals, but seeing that beautiful, smooth, shiny side of the grill, one of them simply couldn't resist. And when he touched it, he was so surprised at how much it hurt. And I wanted so much to say, "Child, what did you expect?" I didn't say it. But I thought it. We told you it was hot, that it would hurt. What did you expect? This morning, I want to ask you and to ask myself the same thing. What do you expect? What did you expect when you came here this morning? You are here on this gorgeous late May morning, on a weekend when many of your friends and neighbors and family are up north or out camping or at home. It's a holiday weekend, and the rest of them are out there holidaying. But you and I are here. And what are we here for? What did you expect? What do you expect? We come to this place each Sunday, we sing our hymns, listen to music and words, lift our prayers, read our Bibles, offer one another signs of peace and love. What for? This morning we heard a story, a first-person report of a man who had a what-for moment. If he ever wondered afterwards what he was doing anything for, all he would have to do was look back at that life-changing, life-defining moment, and he would know. His name was Isaiah, and his story starts in the same place we are this morning, a sanctuary. He has entered the place of worship. He doesn't tell us what he was expecting, but he does tell us what happened. The room fills with smoke. The structures shake from the very foundations. Angels wing their way around the throne, calling out to each other, shouting, "Holy, the border between heaven and earth dissolves. Isaiah is undone. I would be too, wouldn't you? I've been to church a lot in my life. You probably have too. And I've never had anything like that happen. If you have, tell me about it. I want to know. Isaiah had a full-bodied, multi-sensory encounter with the living God. Is this the way it's supposed to be when we come to church? I don't know. I do know we can't manufacture that kind of experience. Even so, Isaiah's story is an invitation to consider the invisible reality towards which all our hymns and all our prayers and all our sermons and even all our passing of the peace point. The dazzling, devastating presence of a holy God. Isaiah's experience of God's presence was shockingly direct. It is, in fact, painful, a stark reminder that to draw near to the living God can be not only beautiful, but severe, sharp, painful. Our own encounters with God's presence may not remotely resemble Isaiah's experience, but the angels in the story do tell the truth. They say, "The whole earth is full of God's glory." The Hebrew word for glory, kavod, has at its root the concept of heaviness. It is as if God's character, beauty, truth, goodness, love, beyond comprehension, is so substantial that it cannot be confined to the heavenly realm. The weight of it, the largeness of it, the power of it breaks through the veil. The declaration of the angels blurs the margin between heaven and earth. All of it is loaded with God's glory, they proclaim. For Isaiah, that glory broke through in the sanctuary, and he saw it, he smelled it, he heard it, he felt it. What about us? Do we believe the earth is full of God's glory? English poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning famously wrote, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and pluck blackberries." Priest and poet Gerard Manley Hopkins likewise proclaimed, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." And contemporary Native American poet Joy Harjo similarly gives voice to the breakthrough of God's glory in the world, writing, "To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon." Like the poets, Isaiah's experience challenges us to expand and clarify our own perception. If we have come to worship seeking an experience of God, then we also ought to be looking for God's glory out there in the world and expecting to find it. "The whole earth is full of God's glory," the angels chant to each other as they swoop around the sanctuary. And the fact that Isaiah caught his vision while he was in the place of worship is instructive. If we're going to look for and find God's glory in the common bush, then this is where we come to sharpen our eyesight. We come to worship. We come not to replicate or approximate or manufacture a reality-shattering experience like Isaiah's, not that we could do so even if we tried. But we come to renew our imagination, to fire up our expectation, to enhance our vision, our perception. Maybe our experience of God is limited less by the border between heaven and earth than it is by the firm boundaries around our own imaginations. So Isaiah gives us a glimpse of the terrain beyond those boundaries. What would you do differently this morning if you truly expected to encounter the glory of God here? More to the point, what would you do differently each day this week if you truly looked for and expected to encounter God's glory in the people in your life, in the animals you live with, in the flowers or plants that you water each day, in the sun that rises and sets whether or not you're paying attention, in the meal that you take the time to prepare, in the work that you dedicate yourself to? Isaiah's encounter with God turned his life upside down, shaken by what he witnesses in the sanctuary. He makes the only response he can: confession. True awareness of God's holiness draws us also towards true awareness of our human horror, that we have failed to live in harmony with that holiness. Maybe all human failure has its origin in our inadequate awareness of the glory of God shimmering in every atom of the cosmos. If we truly comprehended the reality that earth is heavy with the glory of God, could we allow our government to separate children from their parents and then lose some of them? If we truly believed that the earth was crammed with heaven, could we tolerate the degradation of the earth, let alone participate in it? If we truly saw the grandeur of God woven into every cell of reality, could we treat the people in our lives as anything less than divine gift? If we truly understood that the earth is full of God's glory, could we fail to take care of our own precious lives? Could we fail to do everything we could to live up to our own highest purpose? But we have failed, and we do fail in so many ways. Confronted in a shockingly direct way with God's presence, Isaiah cannot help but also be confronted by his own failure and the failure of his people to live in alignment with that glory and that goodness. Like a child reaching out to touch something beautiful but too hot, his closeness to God's holiness fills him with pain, and he pronounces judgment against himself. Woe is me, I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, living among a people of unclean lips. And maybe you shrink from the language of shame and self-judgment, but Isaiah's response actually shows us the path towards liberation. Think about all the social conflicts and ethical failures in our world today at the personal level, the interpersonal, the communal, the national, the global. How does any of it change unless and until individuals are willing and able to claim their own role in it? In simple, straightforward language, Isaiah confesses sin on both the individual and systemic levels. Woe is me, I am lost. And I don't know about you, but when I think about the big issues in our world, like racism, gun violence, poverty, nationalism, xenophobia, environmental disaster, I feel lost too. Where do we start with making any kind of positive change? Isaiah reminds us, the transformation of systemic evil begins with admitting our own part in the mess. We cannot confront and challenge and change the evils out there unless we're also willing to confront and confess the darkness and sin in here. And people are not willing to do that, but are we? The disruption and subversion of entrenched patterns of evil and sin always depends on telling the truth, including our individual part in it. Woe is me, I am lost. But no sooner does Isaiah speak his sin than it is destroyed. An angel flies to him, holding a burning coal, touching the coal to Isaiah's mouth and saying, "Now that this has touched your lips, your guilt has departed and your sin is blotted out. The searing pain has a purifying effect, the healing of a wound, the beginning of transformation." From a psychological perspective, we know how this works. When we name our shame, we take away some of its power to hurt us or others. Theologically, Isaiah's story points to something more profound. God does not seek our guilt, but its obliteration. As old as Isaiah's story is, this core truth seems fresh, a beautiful repudiation of our twisted understanding of God's nature. So many of us carry this deep, painful suspicion that God desires our shame and our punishment. Isaiah's experience in the temple dares us to see past our suspicions and our fears, to behold the radical reality that God's intention has never been our shame. God's intention is the healing of our shame, the blotting out of our guilt, the undoing of all the ways we and all humanity distort God's glory in our world. And now in Isaiah's story, a voice calls out. It's the voice of God asking, "Whom shall I send and who will go?" And now at last we hear God's own hope and expectation that there would be someone to speak God's word to the world. Isaiah isn't called by name. He volunteers. Set free from sin, shame, and guilt, he shows us what freedom is for listening, for hearing the divine longing for the world, and for responding. In freedom, this is what we can do too when we move from worship to seek God's glory, to serve God's goodness, to share God's grace with the world. You could have been anywhere this morning, doing anything, but you came here, and what are you expecting? Whether you are expecting it or not, whether you sense it or not, the loving presence of a holy God burns among us, maybe even within us. And when worship ends today, and we all head back out there to our homes and our neighborhoods and later to our places of work and school, what will you be expecting there? Will you look for the glory of God? Will you expect to find it? It is there beyond our imagination and even our expectation. And what's more, there is also this. God is expecting something too. And who will respond?